Hi, John.
Hey, Alex.
Do you know what I hate?
What's that?
Sandworms.
Sandworms, you know I hate them.
Yes. In the movie Beetle. Oh, I almost said it.
Oh, that would have been bad. This is going to be a tough episode.
Don't sing if you want to live long. They have no use for your song. You're dead, you're dead, you're dead. You're dead and out of this world.
Let's get pedantic really early.
Oh, good.
Why is it spelled three different ways? And I think maybe only one of which is correct, or all three are wrong.
The title of the movie being the more basic, Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
Simply marketability. It's to get the rubes.
Yeah.
Not calling it like Beetlejuice.
Yeah, no, it's a hard word to pronounce looking at, but in the movie, is car the first time they show it is spelled B-E-E-T-E-L-G, like it's spelled wrong. Mm-hmm. And then I think on the when he gets the first commercial, it starts being spelled like the way the astronomical body is spelled.
Right.
And it's just a weird, I don't know. It's one of those, it's Tim Burton, so I'm overthinking it. Like, is this some weird, some weird deep thing I'm not getting? Like some
right,
meta.
Did he do it on purpose or was it an oversight?
Yeah. Because it seems like he's the type that would put in like some meta joke of like, this is the reality. You know, this is like that scene where like they're in the office and there's like an audience watching them. And it's like, hey, we're the audience watching an audience. It's like, is there some meta spelling joke I'm not getting? So one more small bit of pedantry just to get it out of the way. No, this isn't pedantry. This is an Alex staple. John, what do you think I have a problem with in this movie?
Somebody's teeth.
Oh, a lot of people's teeth. There are a lot of yellow teeth in this movie.
Well, sure. There's a lot of dead people.
No, like Alec Baldwin's got some yellow ass teeth.
I didn't even notice.
Jeffrey Jones, although, you know, a terrible human being, also terrible teeth. Everybody but Geeta Davis and Winona Ryder have yellow ass teeth.
Hmm.
And I was thinking, could it be like the 80s? You know, because we did get vainer and vainer and everybody got thinner and thinner and more perfect as Hollywood moves on. Is this like the end of the 1970s? You could just have shitty yellow teeth and it doesn't matter as a leading person.
Sure. I have no idea.
You should know these things. You're my co-host. You're my co-host with the
maybe
most.
Maybe they were all smokers. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe that was still cool.
That's probably true. It was the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in my research, a lot of stuff about teeth didn't come up.
Well, I think you should know by now to start looking deeper. You know,
yeah, start.
Cover the dental aspect.
Yeah.
All right. So, I guess we should put some context there. So, this is the start of our Tim Burton series.
Right.
We're going to do a few movies of his. And I'm not sure if we decided how many yet, but whatever. We're doing a few Tim Burton movies. This is the earliest of our sampling. I have a hard time not taking in my current boredom of Danny Elfman music. Like,
right.
Because it's so overdone at this point. Because I've heard this arrangement a million times since then. So I'm like trying to like reorient myself because it's a very present score. Like it's there a lot. And I think I would love it if it hadn't been done a million times. It's like if all of the arrangements didn't remind me of every subsequent movie. Like there's so much like Nightmare Before Christmas and
sure,
all the other stuff that came later in it that it's like it's hard to not feel. It's almost like later John Williams. I mean, this is going in the opposite direction. We're like, you're just stealing shit from the earlier movies because you're being lazy.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, like, Danny Elfman has a particular style and arrangement that he likes to do. And it sounds very similar. But this was a very early iteration of all that. Nostalgia-wise, I still enjoy it because I always liked it. And then I liked the cartoon, the Beetlejuice cartoon as well. And obviously shared a theme song. So it didn't bother me as much, but I understand exactly what you're saying, where it's like the way that certain bands have a sound, but that sound makes all their songs sound exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like top of the dome, I'm going to say Alice in Chains.
Like, yeah, totally.
That's a very dated reference. You know, there was the thing about like all Linkin Park songs sound the same, where you could play them simultaneously and the same shit happened.
I mean, we're talking about a movie from 1988. Fucking Alice in Chains is relatively modern in comparison. That's like that's a solid that's 3 years later.
Yeah.
It's not that it bothered me. It's just it was hard for me to distance myself from the 20 plus years of history, you know, between then and now. So it was just kind of like, listen, there was a lot of points where it sounds like the Simpsons theme is about to start, where you're just like, oh, no, I can't. this is wrong. I'm anachronistic in my noise. It's just that it's
for Homer.
Yeah. It's so present in the film. And I think it's really effective, but it's yeah, it's very Danny Elfman.
But I love the whole opening of this.
Yeah.
Where it's the sort of the classic helicopter shot over this quaint village, New England village, transitions into being the model that the main character, Adam Maitland, is making. And it ends on this house, and a spider crawls over the house. And when I was a kid and I saw that, I remember that scaring me, because I don't like spiders anyway, but I didn't really put it together that it was a model.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a really beautiful, I love the opening of this. I even commented that the pacing of like the kind of first like 10 minutes is so smart. Like how fast and how like even the actors are moving quickly and talking quickly. And it really, because this movie is it's very horror centric for a kind of comedy. Like this movie's dark as fuck.
Yeah, so, it was initially way darker.
Yeah, I think it was originally written as just a straight horror, right?
For the most part, this was originally written by this guy, Michael McDowell, and his original script was like, their death in the car is a lot more ghastly. Like, I think she, like, gets her arm, like, Gina Davis' character gets her arm crushed or something, and that's why there's that specific reference to her arm, like, how's your arm feeling? And then like Beetlejuice himself wasn't a thing you conjured. It was this like winged demon that also took the form of a short Middle Eastern man, which honestly just made me think of the clown from Spawn. Yeah. So I'm glad they didn't do that. But, yeah. And it was a lot more brutal. Like Beetlejuice wanted to just murder everyone. There were two daughters instead of one. Then, he wanted to just, it wasn't like dressed up as being married. He just wanted to have sex with the older one. And then he like mutilates the younger one while he's transformed into a rabid squirrel or something.
Yeah, and but, Adam Maitland kept telling Lydia that she's a dirty little piggy and her little piggy face needs a...
Yes. That was... Oh, that predicted the future again.
Yeah, weird. Yeah, the best of Alec Baldwin hits. You know, talk about Oingo Boingo sound here.
But, yeah, eventually Tim Burton, like, brought on a second guy to try to rewrite it with him. That wasn't working, so they got rid of him and brought on some guy, Scarin, to like redo the whole thing. And I think the final version really balances this very nicely. It still makes it like this kind of creepy thing, fairy tale thing, but it's a lot more sort of accessible and fun than like downright just gory and terrifying.
Yeah, and I think tone wise, it's the same. But like the opening thing, like the pacing of it, it being upbeat and like kind of.
Yeah,
it could almost be remixed into like an 80s comedy sitcom, like the opening theme, because it's two young, sexy people just they're like jumping over couches or they're making out. They're just everything's really high energy and fun. And that is such a good like tone to enter in, because if it starts off with like if it had started off somehow dour and then cuts to them and goes back to dour, I think the entire movie gets kind of spoiled. Like
I can't help but feel like that's the way we do it now.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
You know, like it's got to be serious. But this is nice, and also delves in nicely to this sort of contrasting theme of the goofy innocence of the two main characters, as kind of like, because like you said, like the start of the movie seems kind of like an old like black and white where everyone's talking super fast. And Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn are really hitting it off. It's that kind of innocent sort of thing.
Oh, that's a really good, that's exactly what it sounds like. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, versus the sort of the cynical New York people that show up later.
Yeah, and even the, we'll get to that in a second. I love one of the parts I adored about the opening, and it's such a cheeseball thing, but they play off so well, is the old man trying to tell a story when he's going into the hobby shop.
That is a line that I quote a billion times. I don't know why. It's always stuck with me. So yeah, Alec Baldwin, they leave. He's making this, they're a couple, they're celebrating their vacation at home. They're taking 2 weeks off. They've got all these projects they want to do, including he has this life, he has this scale size model of the town he's been building. And he needs to go into town to get some stuff and has Gina Davis drive him into town. And they stop at this store. There's an old man sitting outside and he says, you know, hey, the old guy says hi and just starts telling some story. Alec Baldwin goes in the store, does a shopping, comes out. The guy's still telling the story. But he just, it comes back and just the line he says, and he had hair down to his goddamn shoulders. And he says to me, just trim it a little, has just stuck with me for years. It makes me laugh every time. I don't know why.
It reminds me so much. There's a couple spots in here that I had direct Simpsons references that, and a later one we're going to come to that I was ecstatic for. But this one reminded me of that one part where Bart and Lisa are sitting at the kitchen table. Bart's talking to Lisa and he goes, so I says this, Mabel, I says. And then like, I think Homer walks in. He's like, hey, Bart, do you know where, or no, Marge walks in. He's like, do you know where whatever is? He's like, oh, I think he's somewhere anyway. So then he dot, 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 turns back to Lisa. So anyway, I says the Mabel, I says. It's just the dumbest little thing, but that just reminded me so much of this, like, what a dumb mid-entry point. This movie's delightful.
Someone pointed out also that the end of this sort of idyllic opening ends with the car that Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis are in crashing off the side of a bridge while trying to avoid a dog, and that the shaggy dog being there is supposed to be like that this was a shaggy dog story, that this was a long way to go to just have these people die. And while I think it's one of those things that, yes, you can read it like that, whether or not that's intentional, I don't know. I just think it's anti-dog, and I support that.
No, Vern has dogs in most of his movies. It's like one of his...
Like Frankenweenie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was his first movie, was that. And then, Nightmare Before Christmas wasn't directly him. But, he's got dogs in a bunch of them. He's got more dogs than Tarantino's got feet.
Ooh, that's a bold statement.
Yeah. It also, I delivered that like it was part of a Beastie Boys song. I don't know. Like, it just, it
yeah,
sounded.
Yeah, I should have joined you when I said
yeah. Like, I felt like I was just giving the dozens in the middle of like a rap track. Because that's the hippest thing I've ever said. Dang,
that's
damn it.
True, yeah. Love them rap tracks.
Yeah.
They crash their car and immediately end up back at home, now deceased. And they now slowly learn that they are deceased.
I did like... It's somewhere. Well, first them trying to go back outside and they end up in the desert, which later is revealed to be Saturn.
Yeah, in a throwaway line. Yeah, and I love that.
This movie is so fucking weird. I should have, I didn't say it strongly enough at the start because I wanted to find something to bitch about in this movie. And it's vaguely sort of the soundtrack, and it's not the soundtrack's fault. But so, and the score, not the soundtrack, because this might be the best soundtrack in the history of humanity. But this movie is great. Like, I should just really, I need to put this out right now. This movie was, I was enraptured watching this. Like, I was kind of mad how short it was. So I'm like, I want another 15 minutes. Like, this movie's so good.
I think it's just right. I think I'm so charmed by the presentation of it and the look and all the actors are so great in it. That like any sort of like little quibblings I might have with it sort of fall away. But there is sort of, it's pretty light for dealing with the the afterlife and all that stuff. Like, it's the story is kind of sparse, whatever, but that's fine. It's still so much fun.
Yeah. I mean, in the after, so when you die, you go back to your house for 125 years or whatever the hell it is. They don't really explain all that much. And then if you try to leave, you end up on Saturn with sandworms. It's fucking amazing.
Now, I guess initially there were going to be a bunch of in the original script, there were a bunch of different like limbos they would walk into. Like one was Gears that was like chewing up the fabric of reality, almost like the Langoliers or something. But I just like that. No, it's Saturn.
Yeah, it's so weird.
That's fine. Yeah.
Saturn's weird enough. It's Saturn with the extra level added difficulty of claymation sandworms. Like, it's so fucking odd.
Well, apparently a lot of the effects on this were meant to be cheesy because he only had, for a $50 million movie, he had $1 million only for visual effects work. And so wanted to kind of make it a little bit more like B and B movie and like cheap looking. But I really think it works. Some of that stuff I just sort of chalked up to being like, oh, it's an 80s movie or something. But I mean, the claymation stuff and the goofball stuff with the model is so much fun. And they do so much with just set design that really makes this seem like this whole other world.
Yeah.
And which I guess was done by this guy, Bo Welch, who he worked with on Edward Scissorhands and Batman Returns, and met his wife. Bo Welch met his wife, Catherine O'Hara, on this movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Lucky guy. Catherine O'Hara is, now that I've aged up enough to like kind of see her as a woman, va va voom.
Well, she's just wonderful in this. And I've been watching Schitt's Creek lately. I hadn't watched that before. And she's fantastic at that. I've always liked her. But going back and revisiting this now.
Yeah.
She is so good in this, so funny, because she's so like unlikable as a character, but she still has this humanity to her that she brings through, and I really like that.
I don't know, what would you describe that as? Like, kind of, I always wanted to say anti-hero and I stopped myself, but it's got that same vibe where it's like, I like you, but you're fucking awful.
Yeah, she's just crazy, but there's a certain amount of vulnerability there.
Yeah. And I also like the, I don't know if this is going to resonate with you as much, but I like the 1980s description of what the New York people are like.
Yes.
Like, it is so, like, it is, I don't know, that was just so, like, living kind of in the shadow of New York growing up. Is it always made me laugh because one, those accents are somewhat accurate, like, well, mostly the insulting Michael Keaton versions where he does, like, weird, yeah, anyway, we'll get to that. Yeah, it's episode one level delicate when it comes to other races, but
the good old late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, I love that. It just, and Alec Baldwin is for some reason, a feature of a lot of New York movies, you know, the very much not New York Baldwin.
Uh-huh. The, and so getting into the afterlife that they live in, which is now like this, ruled by this crazy bureaucracy. David Lynch has said before in describing different movies that like, that this was a world he liked to live in. That, you know, like watching something like Sunset Boulevard or something. It's like, I just like the world of the movie. And for me, that is so true in this. Like, as much as a pain in the ass that this all looks, I just want to hang out in this world. Just both the real world and the afterlife here. Because it's just so weird and scary and fun, but not really, like, threatening. You know, it's you have dudes that have been run over making crappy jokes.
Yeah.
Which I have a question about, because you find out later that, or you find out Otho, Catherine O'Hara, the Dietz's sort of spiritual and fashion advisor.
Yes. The late, great Glenn Shaddix. What
about, and he is
up
just
there,
great.
Up there on my list of favorite that guy actors. Like, yeah. He's just, maybe not up there on the list, but he's one of those people that just brings it every time he's on screen.
Yeah, just fantastic. And he makes a comment about, if you kill yourself, you're a civil servant in the afterlife.
Yeah, which I love, because we've already met all the civil servants of the afterlife, and they all have subtle references to having, so, like, them having killed themselves. So,
yeah, the receptionist is slitterist. Juno, the Maitland's caseworker, has apparently slit her throat. But like the squashed guy, did he do that to himself?
I mean, you could run out in front of a car, you know, that's a phrase.
That's what's it. I also like the everyone who's dead looks like how they died. There's, you know, there's a dude hung from a noose that's handing out papers to people.
That's the darkest thing in the film. You take a half a second to think about how fucking dark that is.
Yeah. Well, that, and the fact that the when the flattened guy isn't working, he just goes into a slit in the wall.
Yeah.
That's kind of upsetting too, but... the Maitlands don't, cause they in theory would be bloated and wet and whatever.
Well, did you read the trivia on that?
Well, some of it was that they said that having the actors be wet the whole time, which is going to be a pain in the butt.
Yeah. I love that as an explanation. Yeah.
Yeah. But I also just, I don't know, it's for the sort of movie logic of this, where it's like, no, the pretty people are okay.
Well, so
I'm okay with it.
I mean, so my main question with that is the receptionist. Why is she green?
Don't know.
Because she's like Star Trek alien green, like sexy green, not like, you know, dead green.
You know, she's maybe had something to do with the beauty pageant she was in. I don't know how Argentina does things.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, because all the girls at the strip club later are like red.
Yeah, I don't know, just ghosts. That's how they do it, I guess.
Yeah, this whole movie is like one giant delight. I can't remember like what order things happened in. I've got full blanks. So they die. They're trying. Oh yeah, they find the guy to the recently deceased, and
for the recently deceased. Yeah,
yeah, I love Baldwin going recently diseased, and Gina Davis going deceased. What a fun little. Fun little aside that happened there. I wonder if that's a...
Well, it's a nice little callback, too, later when he's reading the Beetlejuice flyer and he says the name wrong.
So do you want the Handbook to the Recently Deceased? Would you want to read that? Like, I'm not saying, like, in a world... Like, in our world, I don't mean, like, as a movie memorabilia thing. I mean... An actual copy of the Rules to the Afterlife get handed to you. Would you want to read it?
That's a good question, because initially, yes, but I think it would take some of the mystery out of stuff and would be less fun. And I think I would try to live my life in a stupid way to get ready for that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to spend a lot of time shuffling papers and organizing things so I know where they are in the afterlife. And I'd rather make that future me's problem.
Yeah. Well, that's also the thing, too, of like it being really confusing and hard to read is just like, oh, God, I'm going to be too dumb for this in the afterlife, too. Like, this is going to be such a pain in the ass.
Yeah. And I like how that's never really explained. And again, it's something that I felt, maybe incorrectly, but I felt would be something that they'd want to spend more. If you were to make this movie today, I feel like there'd be a lot more time spent explaining a bunch of stuff to you.
I'm glad they did.
Because it's just like, well, who made this book? And it just says the Handbook for the Recently Deceased Press.
Yeah,
like that's delightful. It. It's just this miasma of bureaucracy that has these rules. I don't know why it doesn't. These are just the rules, though.
Yeah, it reminds me of I risk being the most pretentious I've ever been on the show, but it reminds me of Kafka. Like where mm-hmm. if you've ever read The Trial, where it's just kind of like, well, you're on trial because you're on trial. It's right. Because you're guilty. It's like this guy kind of bureaucratic circular logic. So it's like, yeah, the Handbook for the Research of the Deceased is, well, who made this? The Handbook for the Research of the Deceased Company. Like this kind of, well, didn't you read the book? I don't understand the book is why I came for help. Well, you should read the book to find help. It's like, yeah, right. You know, this, you know, it's like tax forms. I think it's
done just enough to it's a bit, you know, I don't feel like it's trying to make any kind of grand statement or anything.
Yeah.
It's just, as you say, a fun little bit of business.
Yes. In as far as me admitting things here, we're about to get to the point that we introduced to the Dietzes.
Yes.
Is it okay that I still have a crush on Lydia?
I don't think I'm qualified to answer.
Just keep in mind, she was older than me when this movie came out.
Right.
And I don't mean now it's more like I have like a fatherly affection for her, but like I still have love for her. Like she really like influenced a lot of my life. Like.
Oh, sure. I think you're just re-feeling those old feelings.
When she dramatically sighs, my whole life is a dark room. Like,
yes.
Same Lydia. Same.
Yeah.
Yeah, she plays it really well. This is kind of an understated performance. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple spots like that and where, you know, spoiler alert, which she's writing her suicide note later, is so funny. But really dark. I mean, obviously she's writing a suicide note, but her like it's like really shitty writing. Like one, her handwriting is ghastly, and then but her actual like writing style is like she's like I'm very very sad or whatever the fuck she says. Like it's right. So like it's
we're
really...
just being, writing it like so dramatically. It made me think of there's a great Kids in the Hall sketch where Bruce McCullough tries to kill himself. Apparently he wrote this like 3-volume suicide note that no one wants to read. But they're talking about how this other friend of theirs killed themselves, and his note was so good.
Yes. Yeah, her note later is – yeah, but Winona Ryder's delivery there, it's like that kind of – it's a hard line to walk of like trying to deliver that with like, you know, not going too overly dramatic but still doing it serious and not being – or going to overly kind of sticky.
Yeah, and I think this – not to sort of just keep saying the same thing over and over again, but I think the movie really balances that really well. And I'll get into that a little bit more talking about Michael Keaton and his performance. But I think like when we meet the Dietz, there's a lot of stuff that I kind of didn't really put together when I was a kid. Like I kind of had a lot more sort of sympathy for Jeffrey Jones's character when I was younger as Mr. Dietz, because he's just, oh, he's had this nervous breakdown and he's out in the country. But his zany family is making that difficult with his art wife and sad daughter. But he's awful too, because he wants to just cash in as soon as possible. And I just kind of I gave him the benefit of the doubt, I guess, when I was younger watching this movie. But he's super terrible.
Yeah, and you both belong to all the same websites, you know.
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, but you know that dark web stuff. Remember when you told me about the dark web?
JohnAlexHateStuff.com.
Yeah. How you were like, hey Alex, this Jeffrey Jones guy gave me this great idea. Can you tell me how to get on the dark web? I'm like, I don't know, John. I don't know if I can explain that to you.
What's a Tor?
Yeah.
Despite being an awful person in real life, I do enjoy Jeffrey Jones's performance here.
Yeah, it's a real, I mean, this is such an overstatement, but like, it's a real bummer. Because like, he's in a lot of really great movies, and it's like, bummer is obviously the wrong word, but it's like extra, you asshole. Like when you're like a human pile of dumpster fire and like you're like the worst, but also like, fuck you for ruining a lot of good movies now. Like now, like Beetlejuice is now tainted by you being a fucking like, monster.
It's nasty. But so that since they've been dead now, the Maitlands have been dead for months, I believe, at this point, and the Dietzes have bought the house and are moving in and renovating everything. This is where we're introduced to Otho, played by, as we said, the great Glenn Shaddix.
He's so great in this.
And they start tearing down and decorating the house, so the Maitlands decide, well, we need to get these people out of here, they're ruining our house. And then you get some funny moments of them trying to haunt people. And this scared me when I saw it when I was the first a kid, where they, in an attempt to haunt them, like they open a closet and there's Gina Davis hanging there and she pulls off her face.
That's startling. That actually, I mean, it didn't get me now, but it like, it, it, It's not pleasant as a middle-aged man.
It's the first like really big turn, I feel like,
yeah,
where it's really creepy. But yeah, that doesn't work. Then that's when they struggle to they're struggling to do the haunting, and so they reach out. Having read the handbook, they draw a door.
Well, before that, we see the first time we meet Beetlejuice. It's the commercial on the TV shows up.
Mm, right.
Yeah, because they're all frustrated, and then like Beetlejuice is in a commercial.
Well, he has found them because. You get this like this little vignette of him underground reading about sandworms in a newspaper that I guess the dead people get.
Yeah,
it's like, time to drum up some business.
And the dead times. The obituaries. Yeah.
And they're all like, I like how they're all just like, welcome. So there's something where it's like train wreck welcomes Maude and June Cleaver, whatever it was.
Yeah. But, wait, I'm gonna deliver this in the John Rye style. Hey, talk about a prescient thing about the newspaper business.
Nice.
I like your side mouth delivery sometimes, and I wanted to use it, and I did right there.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, they get this commercial. It's supposed to be like a used car dealership commercial, and I guess he's pretending to be someone specifically that if you know these commercials, you knew the reference. But otherwise, it's just cheesy car commercial guy.
Oh, is that? I didn't realize it was an actual reference. I thought it was him just doing.
I read that somewhere, but it's someone I didn't recognize.
There's. I mean, should we just talk about Michael Keaton now? I mean, okay. Michael Keaton in this movie as Beetlejuice, and I want to be very careful on this because I enjoy his performance.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing what Robin Williams wanted to, because he's dead as fuck now.
Right.
That string of just say shit until something's funny happens,
mm-hmm.
and it works in this because he's supposed to be kind of unlikable.
Right.
And it's exactly like watching this. I'm like, oh, this is such a great example of why I don't like Robin Williams, because this isn't likable, but it works really well of just.
Yeah. And this is what I was talking about earlier with the tone thing, where I couldn't help but think about, because his character is essentially like a Bugs Bunny kind of character. This sort of irritating, but thinks he's funny, like does comical things. But sort of this chaotic force, like just like Bugs Bunny. But I couldn't help but think about, like, again, sort of a more recent version or something, like a Jim Carrey playing this or something like that. Or again, like a Robin Williams, where it's not too much the way Michael Keaton does it. There is a certain desperation to it, and like particularly when he's meeting them and trying to get them meeting the Maitlands and trying to get them on his side, then he's just like really, really using the grease gun and trying, but still like, you know, being awful to Gina Davis and all that stuff. And rather than like just being that way and really relishing every moment of it, I don't want to reuse the word vulnerability because I don't think that's true here, but there's a certain amount of I think just churlishness about the whole thing that a goofier presentation of that wouldn't have. And I like that a lot.
Yeah, it comes across really well. The I kept thinking about how this is like the kind of version of The Mask with Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
And it's like basically just replace Swing with Calypso. And it's like very similar. But Jim Carrey had like the more manic side to it down. And not to say that The Mask is terrible or whatever, but like it's, you know, there's a reason we don't talk about The Mask and Beetlejuice is still like, you know, somewhat part of the zeitgeist. I mean, it's like, I'd go so far as to say a classic. That, yeah, but Michael Keaton really lands this. This movie really did like walk a fine line, and Michael Keaton lands it. And I think the writing of Beetlejuice helps that a lot. Because he's not supposed to. I mean, it's weird because he turned into a hero in the Beetlejuice cartoon.
Yes.
That's like best friends with Lydia.
Lydia, which is really creepy.
The child he literally fondled a couple times in the film. Oh, no, he fondled Gina Davis. I don't think he ever fondled Lydia, but he did try to marry her. But
yes.
The choice to make Beetlejuice not hateable, but like he's not like the anti-hero, like kind of backdoor lead character.
Right.
He's meant to be disgusting. And that's a good choice, because like The Mask is supposed to be somewhat sexy. While Robin Williams is inexplicably supposed to be funny. Like there is this trying to be likable and having that energy is, I think, difficult. And that's why that's why you end up liking him more. It's like, oh, what a shithead. This guy's great.
Yeah. Because he's also is the villain of the piece. And
yeah.
You never, I feel like you never forget that for a moment. Like even though you might be enjoying some of his antics, there is still something very bad afoot. And you I think Michael Keaton does a very good job of keeping that kind of at the level it needs to be.
Yeah. It's not as bad as I was expecting it being an 80s movie, but there's a lot of like Jewish voice going on.
Yes. Yeah.
It's fine. You know, they do run the media, so they could just stop the movie if they right. wanted to. But there's some uncomfortable kind of Star Warsian. I was expecting him to do Chinese voice or something at some point. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like this is the era of Billy Crystal. So it's that was to be expected.
Yes. Well, I did like the scene where Beetlejuice shows up in full blackface and does right. a jazz well, character.
His favorite character, the jazz man.
Yeah. And then talks about how he likes how he liked baseball with his demon dad or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It was touching.
I think the line that ages worse in this movie is, I saw The Exorcist 167 times and laughed.
It keeps getting funnier every time I see it. Yeah.
One, like hearing fucking in a movie like this, you know, yeah. PG-13 or whatever it is.
Nice. I don't think that's where the F-bomb is. The F-bomb is only dropped when he's like, nice fucking model.
Oh, yeah. But that joke doesn't age well in that The Exorcist is, you know, it's a well-remembered movie, but like, it's not remembered as like the scariest movie ever, which is what the reference was back in 88. That it was like this holy shit scary movie. Now it's like, oh, that quaint 70s horror movie. Yeah. I still think it's
great, but I understand where you're coming from.
Oh no, I'm not saying it's bad. It's just it aged weird. Of like, uh-huh. I think you have to be our age to even like know what that like. If somebody's 10 years younger than us, I don't think they're going to understand that that's a reference to that's the scariest movie ever made. That is
right. But I also just think that again, go back to this tone thing where he does this goofball thing of becoming all like serious, like, oh my, when they ask for his like references or his.
Yeah. It's like, I'm a graduate
CV,
of Juilliard.
Basically. Yeah. He's like, oh, I graduated Juilliard. I was in the Harvard Business School. And as it just keeps getting crazier and crazier and more angry. I like that a lot. So I think I enjoyed the performance more than the line itself.
Oh, you know, totally. Yeah. I was there until like after the line was over. Then I went, really? The Exorcist? Oh yeah. It's, you know, 1988. Mm-hmm. I'm very aware of my age this year. That there's any of those lines that just kind of like it sucks me out of my soul for a bit, or just like, oh boy, yep, I'm of the age that I get why that's a thing. But you know.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was only able to just watch this today, and before I watched it, I heard the news that apparently the Goofy movie is 25 years old. It's the 25th anniversary. This is not a movie I've seen.
I saw that in the theater.
It is a cultural reference for some people, but I felt so old where it's like, even the shit I don't know is too old now.
You know, I saw that in the theater. A very Goofy movie, you mean?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I didn't mean that as a correction. There could have been a million of them. I saw that in the theater with my girlfriend at the time because we were really, really bored and had nothing else to do. Mm-hmm. That's 25 years?
Yeah.
Wait, how old am I? So I would have been 15 at the time? Yeah, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy. Well, okay, I would have been 14. Let me hold on to 39 for a little bit longer. Yeah, okay, I feel old.
Yeah, this was a nice way to, with that sort of view of mortality happening in my mind, this was a nice movie to kind of address that, but in a way that was acceptable to me. So I guess what I'm saying is thanks for letting us laugh about death all over again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, boy, 25 years. I feel very, yeah. Okay, let's back to the movie. Beetlejuice commercial. Oh, yeah, so they draw a door that they found from the
handbook.
One of the things that annoyed me about this, and in a good way, like the movie did well in that, is just read the fucking book. Every time they open it, they keep flipping pages. Read the next fucking page, asshole.
It's so boring.
Why? Yeah, but he drew a door and goes, oh, I don't know what to do next, and flips three pages ahead. That's not how books work. The information goes in a linear pattern. Read the next fucking page.
But books are dumb.
Yeah, I get it.
I support this movie.
I get it. That this is like a tacit, you know, kind of implied way to say that, John, your theory of books are correct.
Yeah.
But I'd say, again, someone that's written multiple books, available on Amazon.com, search for Alex Bolan, Alex with two X's. You read the books in order, linear. It's not choose your own fucking adventure. Maybe it is. I don't know. I've never read stereo instructions.
Here's what happens, though. So you have this problem, like books are boring, right? And they're terrible, but there's some good stuff in there. Like that's how they find the how to make the door and a couple other things that give them give them ideas. Like something in the book makes Alec Baldwin think about doing the Calypso dance later. But at the end, Otho uses the book to try to kill him. So books are inherently bad.
I hear you. It's like that Bible. Yeah. I mean, you can both summon and dispel a demon. It's, you know, it's fucked up shit.
It's not good.
So they did the whole door thing and they go into the waiting room, which, I mean, I haven't seen this movie in so long, but the flash of memory I had when they go to that waiting room of like, oh, my friends. Like,
oh, right,
like,
yeah.
Bifurcated blue lady and the shrunken head guy and the shark on the fucking scuba diver and then the green lady at the counter. I'm like, oh my God, I remember all this like this is fucking yesterday. And if you had told me, if you had asked me when we proposed this movie, Alex, name the characters that are in the waiting room, I think I would have come up with shrunken head guy from later in the movie. I think that's it. But the second that scene happens, like, oh my fucking God, I am in heaven right now.
Yeah. No, it was.
Or the waiting room to heaven.
It was the equivalent of everyone singing along to a song that comes on the radio in a bar or something like that. You know, like totally, you just can't help it, but have that kind of reaction.
Yes, hold me closer, like Tony Danza, indeed.
The smoking guy when they're waiting in the waiting room and there's the burnt tool crisp
cord smoking.
Like, I knew those lines by heart still to this day, even though I haven't seen this movie in probably 15 years.
Yeah.
But that was so great.
Yeah. God.
And again, like these very dark things that are presented very playfully, that is something that I think Tim Burton does very well.
Oh, yeah. They're waiting.
You're assigned a caseworker. You can only ask them like five questions over the course of 120 some years or have five meetings with them.
Well, what happens at year 126?
That is not explained.
Okay, that's what I thought. Maybe I missed it. Like, are we in, you know, the limbo? Like, is there something after that? Or is like this the totality of the afterlife?
There's Beetlejuice makes a reference, you know, and you don't know whether or not he's telling the truth or not about living through the Black Plague and all that. And since he's sort of like operating outside of the realm of whatever this bureaucracy is, who knows how long he's been around.
Hmm.
But he also like studied under Juno, and who knows how long Juno's actually been. Yeah, it's just again, a thing I don't really want explained, but I like that there is. This vague explanation for it, like that, there's a reason they're trapped in that house. Maybe eventually they'll be able to do something else, but
you know, and Juno is, I know that like teenage pregnancy does age you rather quickly, but like, boy, she did not look good.
No, it was rough. Yeah, considering that this movie was 20 years before that even happened.
Yeah, because Ellen Page, attractive woman, and she does not age well. I mean, especially
she grew into her wrinkles.
I think it's the smoking, you know.
Probably
yellow teeth.
Well, you got to give that up because of the kid.
Yeah, so it's explained that you know, basically like, hey, you guys suck at haunting. Read the fucking book. Why didn't you read the book? That's the throughput of, again, literacy is key.
But again, there's this sort of underlying thing where she knows all this information about them and other people know all this information about them. Like, oh, I heard you tore your faces off and all this stuff. We have not seen or heard of another ghost other than Beetlejuice up until this point. So they're somehow being watched by whatever organization this is.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's where the bureaucracy is. Like, that's the kind of ersatz god in this universe.
Yeah.
So they basically come back with the idea of, oh, read the book better and we'll try to kick you out. For the love of God, don't call Beetle. Don't say his name. And they go back. And this is like my favorite thing that happens in the film. And because I'm an idiot, this is somewhat true. Is Jeffrey Jones, the guy that you love all of his personal beliefs, calls Maxie back in New York. The most.
I just like that I have to be reminded of that.
Yeah.
I forgot that I did that. Yes.
Well, you know, we've been co-hosts for a while. I think you should be used to this at this point. I'm going to make fun of teeth and refer to you as, what'd you call the people that like 17-year-olds?
Well, I'm sorry, what?
What'd you call the people that like 17-year-olds? Use a file.
Oh, it's. I don't know if 17 counts in that. A feeble-file.
Okay, yeah, that word. Yeah. So I'm going to make a reference to you. So Maxie's sitting in his office in New York, and it's the most 1980s New York thing ever. Just like, har, 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 power business, har, har, har. Sitting at his desk. Robert Goulet.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeffrey Jones is trying to get him to visit him in Connecticut. And he's like, well, bring your wife. Bring Sarah, your wife.
Yeah, well, this was also having them go talk to, like, they walk down this hallway, but before we get to Robert Goulet, I think the Maitlands are in the limbo afterlife office thing, and they're walking down this hallway and they end up finding a door and they realize the door leads them to their house, which has now been completely redecorated by the Dietzes. And I like that. I like the way this movie handles these little time jumps in these ways that are still they're disorienting because you're with the Maitlands. But it's handled in this way that nicely, rather than just being a dissolve or, you know, like 3 months later, it makes it seem like a more like solid stretch of time.
Oh, yeah. And it's a nice, I like that kind of fun reveal of they walk through the door and Alec Baldwin's like, this place is getting weirder and weirder. And then you watch in both their faces when they realize they're home and they say, how long have we gone? And then we finally meet Juno, who I guess is somebody that was famous back in the day.
Sylvia Sidney is the actress. She was nominated for an Academy Award for a movie called Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams in 1973.
Oh, that is a pretentious fucking title.
Oh yeah. But she did a lot of, work in like the 30s and a little bit in the 40s. Fritz Lang's Fury, Albert Hitchcock's, Sabotage.
Yeah. She's got a good face, good voice. Mm-hmm. Like she's good in this, but, you could tell she's somebody that was famous that I don't know, you know, it's just got, right. She's got that look of like, yeah, she was hired for a reason. I don't know that reason. I mean, she's great. Well done. I just, you know, mm-hmm. you could tell that she was like a person. Yeah.
Which, and she's also fantastic. The scene a little bit later with the football team. Is another, like a little throwaway bit, but it's something that stuck with me forever. And I think about frequently.
Oh, the football team. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the bit, how the football team slowly realizing that they might be dead and they keep calling her coach for some reason.
Yeah.
I love that whole scene.
Well, she does kind of look like Craig T. Nelson.
Sure. Who doesn't, though?
Yeah.
When you reach a certain age.
Yeah, that's true.
Which makes me think of the awful Dan Aykroyd, John Candy, Chevy Chase movie, Nothing But Trouble, where Dan Aykroyd wears a bunch of prosthesis to make him look like Craig T. Nelson.
You know,
not on purpose, but his characters look like Craig T. Nelson.
Too funny. When I was I didn't make a Nothing But Trouble reference earlier in this fucking episode because I thought it was too fucking obscure, was when I said, I love how they depict 80s New York. And I was thinking the beginning of Nothing But Trouble, where they're just yuppie shitheads. Even though I think technically it's the 90s, but it was written in the 80s, so it was fine. But I'm like, yeah, it's too much to explain. I won't go into it.
So you get this nice moment now where, having taken Juno's advice, the Maitlands now are like, okay, well, we'll haunt them the right way. And they've already met Lydia at this point, the Dietz's daughter, Winona Ryder. And that night, what's the mom's name?
The mom is Catherine O'Hara.
No, thank you.
The mom is Delia.
Delia. I wanted to say Dahlia, but I knew that wasn't right. Delia Dietz is having a fancy dinner party for her agent and a bunch of hip New York people. And when they show up, and I love that it's Dick Cavett, by the way.
Is that who that is?
That's who that is.
I knew we were breaking
it. He has a story about how he suggested some, like the effect with the shrimp had something to do with the suggestion that he had. Of course it did, Dick. Of course it did.
Yeah.
I don't want to spend too much talking about Dick Cavett because that is really, really old. But
I think given it's John and Alex Hay stuff, we should spend at least 20 minutes talking about shrimp.
Yeah. But this is the classic moment where they get possessed and sing Deo around the Harry Belafonte song around the dinner table and start dancing and getting possessed. And it's
we skipped a whole shitload of stuff.
What
is no? When he came back, the first thing they did was they try to haunt themselves with sheets.
With sheets, that's right.
But that's how they meet Lydia. Because that's how they meet Lydia, which is, I mean, kind of an important character moment of them meeting. Gina Davis being the most delightful motherly person of like kind of falling in love with this goth girl, even though she's mm-hmm. the most like. And if I may read from my college, from my high school yearbook, this is a picture. This is what's written under my picture. Live people ignore the strange and unusual. I myself am strange and unusual.
Yeah.
Oh boy, my heart still flutters with the thoughts of Lydia Dietz from when I was fucking whatever years old, but I watched this the first time.
Yeah,
that's weird. Watching seriously as an adult, I have fatherly affection for her, and it is so weird because totally. I used to have a crush of she was like babysitter age the first time I saw it.
Uh-huh. Now it's a thing that getting older you kind of recognize it. It's a little bit of a father thing, but it's also just like, oh, I remember that age.
Yeah. So they end up meeting. She takes pictures of them, which is kind of another character point, or at least another point or whatever. Because I think all of that happens. And then don't they go back to the afterlife area?
No, because they do. They were called Beetlejuice, and the snake thing has happened by this point.
Because
what happens? So they do the dance that they make the people possess and dance around the table. And then so all those squares are now convinced that the ghosts are real. But Lydia is like, no, they don't want to mess with you. They're trying to scare you out of this place. And then they go up to try to get the ghosts, get the maintenance to come down and perform for them. And in doing so, well, Catherine Hara has that great line where like, I will drag you out of there by the nooses you hung yourselves with.
Oh, yeah.
By the ropes you hung yourself with.
We're a little out of order. It doesn't matter.
But the
snake happens after Harry Belafonte.
Yeah. Because they go up trying to get it and they're not responding. But then when they come back down, the snake thing happens and, Beetlejuice turns into a snake and, tries to kill all of them basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a fun moment. When they first call Beetlejuice, like the big, like I'm the ghost with the most, blah, blah, blah. He goes, well, what are your qualifications? Which is a really funny, like, character beat. That's where he does the whole I went to Ryder thing.
Yeah, but yeah.
He does the, remember Philo at the end of UHF?
Mm-hmm.
Where they didn't want to spend money on a big effect, so they just showed tentacles shoving out of his face from behind.
Yeah.
They do the exact same joke in this movie, and I think UHF might be before this.
It might be
same year. I mean, it doesn't matter. It was just too funny that it's like, this is like the same. I think Large Marge might be the same kind of joke. No, you see her face get all weird, but it's very similar.
Yeah, scare the hell out of me.
Yeah.
Actually, UHF is 1 year later. UHF is 89, Beetlejuice is 88.
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, you know, with production time, it'd be in the same year. Yeah.
Right. It predicted UHF.
Yeah.
Time travel.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Harry Belafonte scene we should spend a second on.
Mm-hmm.
That is I mean, I'm not an actor, but that seems like really difficult acting because you have to do a dance number whilst doing dance moves, which are like somewhat joyful, like just in their nature, but also act with your eyes and face of I'm scared. Why is my body doing this?
Yeah, what's going on?
I was kind of trying to switch, especially Catherine O'Hara. I was like, wow, you're like, this is cool. Like, even just like, one, it's a delightful scene, but like, that's a difficult bit of like physical acting, you know?
Yeah, because there's a little bit of like, I'm terrified, what's going on? And then it sort of becomes, this is sort of cool.
Yeah.
I'm actually into this.
And I'm going to read directly from my notes here. Lydia in the corner giggling, oh, my young heart. Because she's like, oh, God, look at you, you little goth girl in the corner. I got issues. That's where I'm not attracted to a 17-year-old or whatever she is, 15, 14. Yeah. I assure you. It's just all these emotions from my youth are coming back up. See, I used to have emotions when I was a young person, and I don't have them anymore, and I'm confused on how to deal with it.
I traded them in my 20s for a job.
Yeah.
So then there's the moment where Beetlejuice becomes a snake and drops Geoffrey Jones onto the floor from high above, and like they hear the commotion going on. And so Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin come downstairs and get rid of Beetlejuice, say home, home, home. Or no, that's how they get back there. Oh, they just say Beetlejuice again three times.
Yeah.
And that makes the snake go away, and Beetlejuice ends up back on the model and is screaming at them. And that's where the ghost whorehouse shows up. That's when they get called back into Juno's office.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Because Juno is yelling at them about like how they had their photos taken, and then like you summoned Beetlejuice and she made the whorehouse too. Distract Beetlejuice. And that's the moment with the football players. Her office is full of football players that have died and keep asking, like, what's curfew like around here?
Yeah.
Where's the men's room?
Yeah. So they decide to do like their stretchy horror faces, which are really nice, especially given how low the budget was for special effects.
Oh, yeah. Where the Alec Baldwin puts his hand through his head and pulls out his nose.
Yeah, I was one of the they had toys made of those, and I was one of those.
Yeah,
but I never got.
Actually, I was at a Halloween party last year where where a couple like was them, like they got the like fancy masks that looked like the
the
prostheses, and they were also like the handsomest and most beautiful people at the party when they took them off. You're like, oh,
yeah.
I like the masks.
Yeah, I liked them before. You can't be delightful and attractive. That's not fun.
Yeah, it sucks.
It happened somewhere right here where they're. They're having like breakfast on their little like bullshit veranda outside the house.
Uh-huh.
And Otho has the best fucking kimono on that's ever happened.
Oh, it's great.
Like
yeah.
a silk, like Japanese style kimono with like, it's like dragons on the breast. Oh, it's so good.
Also the fact that he's still there.
Yeah.
Like I love what a piece of shit Otho is. Like he's just so this, good. This dilettante, just whatever that has suckered the Lydia Dietz.
You know, he is... Otho, and I sorry to people that listen to my other show, because it's going to be like a shitting of him a little bit, but there's so many Othos in the paranormal, like, occult community, oh. which I belong to.
Yeah,
there's so
that.
Many people that think they're fucking, oh, I'm a rock star comic magician slash musician slash paranormal investigator, and I'm good at like interior design. Like there's so many of those, they think they're great at everything and tell you all the stories about the shit they've done. Oh, that was back for a week when I was the blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, shut up, Otho. There's so fucking many of those. And I kind of want to like recommend watching this to see if, I mean, none of them are self-aware enough, but it's, yeah.
But yeah, no, that was just wonderful. And again, just Glenn Shaddix is just plays it still with that confidence of he 100% believes that he's good at this stuff,
yeah.
even though he's not.
Oh, by the way, did he paint one of the walls vermilion?
No, Viridian.
Viridian, god damn it. Okay, because every time I hear that, it's that PFT thing that you and I have talked about 100 million times.
Yeah.
I think we probably referenced that more than we referenced hot chocolate from Timothy Zahn.
But at this point, I do really like this scene where Lydia is looking for the Maitlands, and they're gone in Juno world or, you know, whatever in this bureaucratic effort.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Beetlejuice is on the, still hanging out in the whorehouse, which is like shut down now, but he's just sunning himself on the roof of it in the model. And just when they have that discussion about like, she's trying to get him to maybe like, she wants to die. Like she's upset and wants to die. And when she says that to Beetlejuice, she's like, why? And I like that little moment. And I guess in one of the original versions or previous versions, there was supposed to be a whole thing where you see Beetlejuice alive in like the 1800s or something like that, try to hang himself. And rather than do it successfully, he does it wrong and quote unquote hilariously chokes himself to death instead of, you know, like breaking his neck. And so that was supposed to let us know that he knows how bad being dead is. But I more like the idea that he's been alive forever. And it's the reason he is this way is that he's just bored and hateful. She's like, why would you want any of this?
Yeah, no, that's a better read. No, no, I enjoy that much better. Yeah.
Yeah, because he wants out. So, but that's when he starts to take a real serious shine to Lydia. I mean, he was already making some comments before, but she almost says his name three times. Then the Maitlands show up and stop him.
Hey, do you think there's like a, you know, before where you're talking about how you're attracted to 17-year-olds, do you think that there's...
Is that me?
Yeah. Do you think there's a, like a, you know, you're saying like, what's the word? Hebephile?
Ephebophile.
Ephebophile.
Now, the only, I will say this, the only reason I know this...
Rick and Morty fans?
No, is we've talked about it on the show, referencing that awful Milo Yiannopoulos thing.
Oh yeah, that's why. Yeah. That's why I know about it, because you tell
right.
you.
But okay, because there's a joke about like that the like that only like the worst people will tell you that there's a difference between being a pedophile and a phoebophile.
Yeah,
and I keep making that distinction.
Okay, like we were talking about that there's, you know, like weird predilections, like files in the human world. Do you think there's like a taboo against ghosts wanting to fuck live people? Like, is there like a vivophile in the ghost world?
Probably, because
like, ew, dude, you're a vivophile. Like Jeffrey Jones, when he's dead, he's like, oh, you're a vivophile. Oh, that's gross.
Yeah, because that would be there would be a lot of cases of that. I think of because, you know, you're a ghost. You can do a lot of stuff to people. I think it's generally frowned upon in the afterlife community.
Yeah, I would think so, because it'd be like, oh, come on, dude, they're all warm and alive. That's gross. Yeah. You want some of that cold puss.
Oh well, I was going for the more moral implications, but no, this works too.
Yeah, but you know, John, you know what's funnier on a podcast than moral implications? I mean, well, just about everything but Jeffrey Jones material. You fucking vivophile.
Yes, I do enjoy living people. I will take that.
Yeah, gross. Give me a talk about Tim Burton. Give me a Corpse Bride anyway.
Yeah.
While they're there, there's Lydia decides to kill herself to join them in the afterlife. And this is where she writes her suicide note of, I am utterly alone, in a really shitty handwriting. Mm-hmm. One, my heart, it hurts. But when I was in middle school, I remember very vividly writing a poem called I Am Alone.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't have it anymore, thank Christ, because I probably would have. I may still have it, and I probably have read it on my podcast at some point because I ran out of material. But, oh boy, there can't be a more one-to-one than that goth-ass lady. That
that hit too close.
Or hit it exactly right. Yeah, so she tries to kill herself while they're on the other side. Gets to the point that she resorts to meeting Beetlejuice in the model in the attic. And he kind of tricks her into bringing him into being, right? Is that what happens?
Lydia does, because the Maitlands, who are now ghost-crazed and want to turn – or not the Maitlands, sorry. The Dietzes are all ghost-crazed and want to turn Connecticut, this little sleepy town of Connecticut, into like the ghost capital of America, because Charles Dietz can't stop wanting to make money. They get Otho to try to do a Otho has the book, the handbook for the Riesling Desist, and tries to do a reverse exorcism. I don't know what you call it, because they are not trying to get the ghosts out. They're trying to make the ghosts.
I'm going to say intracism.
Okay, that works.
What a weird thing to have in a book.
Yes, the one-to-one of that is,
yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Is strange to me, because it seems like, because he's talked about being a paranormal, New York's premier paranormal researcher before. And so I don't know if that's supposed to be directly happening, like lifted from the book or what. It's actually like a poem, I guess.
Well, yeah, no, and he sucks at rhyming, which is because you can see that. So I don't know if this is a good character thing of. So at one point he was trying to rhyme. There was a half rhyme that he didn't do. It was like, it was something that if you pronounce again, would have rhymed. Uh-huh. And he didn't do it. And there's a rhyme mm-hmm. earlier that didn't work.
Well, it honestly made me think of, I had nothing cemented my hatred of poetry more than my high school education, where I had all these terrible English teachers, and not all, but a lot of them. And there was one who was like, would tell me like, no, you're not reading the poem correctly. You have to read it like this. And he would, you know, because people would just want to be like, end on the stanzas kind of thing, you know, like the cat in the hat, he went to the bat, that kind of thing. He's like, no, and he would read it in this really weird, disjointed way that made everybody uncomfortable. And that just made me think of Otho in this moment. But I still like this scene a lot. It actually gave me goosebumps a little bit when he's like, when he's conjuring, because he's conjuring them up, but because Otho is so terrible at everything, he did it wrong, and they're like dying. They're like withering.
Yeah.
Standing there in their wedding clothes. The Maitlands are just like turning to dust, and it's great.
And pretty good. Pretty good special effects for low budget. Like it looks apropos of the film, like for what else is going on.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's also like the way that the makeup is done, particularly on Gina Davis. They conjure her up first and she withers first, is how sad they make her old face look. And so you really feel so bad. I thought that was very effective.
Yeah. RIP Bill Withers, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. That's a bummer.
Because, you know, when Otho used them, he used them up. Don't even know if that's a Bill Withers song, but it worked really well in what I was saying.
I had nothing there.
Yeah. Neither did I, apparently.
because this is going wrong. Yeah. Now Lydia completely brings forth Beetlejuice. But Beetlejuice, his whole thing is like, we have to get married, which is a much more family-friendly rewrite than... You know, I'm a vivophile or whatever you said earlier.
Fuck.
So there is something more like fairy tale and innocent about that, where it's like, no, I got to get my green card through marriage to a living person.
Yeah. And that's a point of confusion. If he gets married, he comes back to life.
Basically. Or like he's at least freed from whatever like the, whatever say like, your like trappings he has.
Yeah,
like,
the say your name three times curse.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's weird because I also don't understand how Otho brings them back to life. Of like, like their bodies aren't there. Like I don't understand what's happening like at all.
Well, it's just the doing the incantation. You know, it's the same way. Like it might be different for someone that studies and knows something about this, but for plebe like myself, it's easy to just kind of go like, yeah, no, he's saying some magic words out of a book, and they have their clothes, and so they're just doing a seance, and that's how this happens.
Yeah, John, here's a punch up for this movie. All right, so Otho starts to read, and then there's 130 minutes of a dark song, and then he goes back to this movie. Much better, right?
Yes, way better.
Because once they do the Bremelin ritual, and then so instead of saying Beetlejuice, they have to do the whole Bremelin ritual, 7 months of austere fasting and having a fat guy that looks like the guy from fucking Hot Fuzz jerk off on you. Then Beetlejuice shows up.
Yeah,
that's a deep callback for the 7 people that saw that episode.
Yeah, so she brings Beetlejuice out, and he hilariously saves the day, I guess, by doing. And again, like this is big and ridiculous, but it's still because he comes out like with a hat that is also a merry-go-round and becomes this like pure carnival barker kind of thing.
So that merry-go-round umbrella hat is like a foreshadowing of everything that's gonna. So we should talk about this in the greater context of Tim Burton. Is a foreshadowing of what happens in his career. Because that becomes like, you can see Nightmare Before Christmas in there. Like, you can see the Batman. Like, there's so much going on in that hat of what his career turns into. Like, I think by the end of our Tim Burton discussion, we should look back at the turning carousel hat and see what we can see, you know?
Yeah. That would be, so there's a giant fish on there. There's a... a planet that may or may not have apes on it.
Yeah, there's the Statue of Liberty half buried. There's that thing that if you push the button, it goes.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah, there's a vampire in England that's looks like Johnny Depp. There's a pair of scissors next to a sausage.
I was so confused for a second because I almost brought up Mordecai, but that's not a Tim Burton movie.
No, it isn't. It's just terrible.
But it just seems like it could be.
So here's the thing we need to bring up. So Beetlejuice comes out and he's trying to get Lydia to marry him. And they do like this whole stage marriage thing. He brings up this crooked Stonehenge looking thing in the wall because I can't think of the right word for that. And then one of the bad guys from Double Dragon comes out to be the priest. Which I don't know what the fuck is happening there, but it's so fucking good.
Yeah, well, that my favorite part of that is when it's all said and done and like they dispatch Beetlejuice, that guy's still just hanging out.
He got paid by the hour, you know.
Well, it just made me think of that Futurama joke where it's like Kif gets married and like who's ever doing the ceremony is like the ceremony is complete, I'm still gonna be here, but you don't have to talk to me.
So over this, Geeta Davis and Al Baldwin are, I think they're getting some of their like ghostliness back. They're like getting less old.
Yeah,
and
Beetlejuice does something to them. Where he stops the whatever is happening to them, and they just go back to normal.
And they try to say Beetlejuice's name a few times, and it doesn't work. And the last time, so Geeta Davis says it twice, and then he ends up sending her out to Saturn Sand Dune area. And as they're about to get married, there's a whole bunch of like, where's the ring, you know, shenanigans. She rides a sandworm through the roof of the house and eats Beetlejuice this movie's so great. Like if you write the beats of this film and try to sell it, it's fucking, this movie's impossibly weird.
Yeah,
and then at the end, the hero rides a fucking worm from Saturn to eat the fucking dead guy. Like what the fuck?
And it all happens very suddenly.
Yeah.
Like it's just all of a sudden, oh, I guess Geeta Davis can control sandworms.
Yeah.
But for this movie, it's like, yeah, sure, why not? Well, like everyone has ghost powers anyway, so why not?
She punched one on the nose before. Maybe that's how you tame a sandworm. I mean, yeah. Paul Atreides did it.
What we needed was, after the 138 minutes of A Dark Song, is then cut in the movie of Gina Davis learning to tame the sandworms.
Yeah, exactly. She's like, well, fear is the mind killer. Fear right. is the fear is the subtle death. And then she goes through the whole thing. She becomes the Quetzalcoatl and then gets on the sandworm. Yeah.
Right. And then loses her eyesight due to atomics and then has to go back into the desert. Yes. Yeah.
Alec Baldwin, he becomes Stilgar. because the house is actually Siege Tabor and more things that people that haven't read Dune won't understand.
You ever read Dune, anybody?
Hey guys, Star Wars isn't nerdy anymore, so we have to start talking about Dune more. They win, everybody's good,
the ending is very interesting because it is this sort of synthesis of because it's revealed that Lydia goes back to school and she's this kind of regular girl now, but comes back home and the Maitlands are acting like her parents, asking her about like test results from class, like how'd your math quiz go, stuff like that. And they're redoing the house. They're bringing it back to what it was before, undoing everything the Dietz had done. But is it on a different floor? You then find it cuts to Charles Dietz reading like how to live with the dead people. And he's like, oh, this reads like stereo instructions. So it's like these families learn to cohabitate, but it seems like the cool New Yorkers were also like, now get what it's like to be innocent and good.
Yeah, I don't know. That it wasn't clear to me what was going on there, but also I'm satisfied and delighted.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is not a genuine concern I have. It was more just like, oh, it seems like that, like for the crux of the fight between these two couples was like, oh, you guys are Ozzie and Harriet and we're these super cool people. It seemed like at the end, like, oh, you know, Ozzie and Harriet's the way to go.
I don't know if it's because I almost called him Stephen King. That's embarrassing. Tim Burton has a weird thing with a kind of like suburban life is equally good and terrible.
Yes.
Like, so I don't really know what like to read about the end. It's,
yeah. I mean, it's definitely presented as positive. Everything's good now.
Yeah. But, I would put up this ending as the best thing that's ever happened in humanity. Like if you say penicillin, the wheel, computers,
vaccine for the coronavirus.
Yeah. Vaccine for the coronavirus, like integrated circuitry, Lydia Dietz dancing to Harry Belafonte. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with Lydia Dietz dancing to Harry Belafonte because it is the best thing that's ever happened in my life.
It's charming enough that I don't ask why the football team is there. Because it doesn't make a lick of sense, but whatever, I'm having fun.
And you can't ask more because that is something that should bother the hell out of you and doesn't because, it is so good. And I love how, like, the character arc of Lydia from like goth girl to dancing in Harry Belafonte makes sense, even though you weren't watching it. Like, it wasn't like you watched her slowly start wearing more colors.
Right.
But it totally tracks. And that's like it's silly, but that's actually like, that's like artistry of character development. Yeah.
Well, it's almost like the two sides of Tim Burton where you have this sort of like gothy, like, oh, my whole life is one dark room. And being obsessed with that kind of ghosts and then ending being like, no, but ghosts can do like fun stuff, like make me dance to Harry Belafonte.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. That's Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
I got it.
It's still holds up. It's still funny. It's still great. It's a movie on like there have been a lot of, I think, attempts to kind of do this sort of thing, but I don't think anything has achieved it the way that this has.
Now, this is slightly like an unspooled territory, another podcast about movies, just to kind of steal that idea.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about it. So they're doing the AFI Top 100 Films is the concept of their show. And then kind of reference other movies that belong on the AFI 100. Tim Burton, as we're discussing him, let's say we have to nominate one of his films to be in the AFI Top 100. You think it's Beetlejuice?
No, I don't, actually.
At this moment, I do. And I look forward to having my opinion changed.
Yeah. Because I think I do like Tim Burton, but I think I'd like this a lot. But I think if I was going to pick a Tim Burton movie to be in the best, and like best of it would be Ed Wood.
Yeah.
I mean, cause this is this in terms of like just a Tim Burton only pantheon, I think Beetlejuice, it might be the most Tim Burton movie, because technically Nightmare Before Christmas is a Henry Selick movie.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
But, this is where he, cause he already kind of was goofy or whatever with Pee Wee's Big Adventure. But this is really when sort of the, what was the sort of Burton aesthetic for a bit with between him and Bo Welch working together on this, and Edward Scissorhands and Batman, like this sort of, his sort of stylistic choices really, really kind of came to the forefront here.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to revisiting and we'll find out.
Yeah.
All right. So Beetlejuice, you know, I think we agreed upon number one AFI movie of all time. Easily.
Sure.
Casablanca can go to Saturn, sit mm-hmm. on a sandworm. what movie do you want to do next, John?
Let's delve a little bit further down the Burton buffet into a controversial dish called Mars Attacks.
Oh, Mars Attacks. It is, if I can, I think this is Abraham Lincoln. It's part of the like third part of the Gettysburg Address, where he goes,
close, and I think that was Frederick Douglass.
Oh, Frederick Douglass. My apologies. I get confused a lot. But I think that really encapsulates my feelings on the film. And if I may just, on a small addendum,
and okay, you know, well, that's a little much, but I understand the emotion behind or the sentiment behind it. I think it's a little, I think you're being hyperbolic to make a point, but I get it. I get it.
Yeah. You know, look, you know, it's the performative self, as we've discussed, and I'm upping my normal stance to try to amuse the audience. And sure. Maybe I have to take back one of the, you know, I did misspell, but you know, we get where we're at.
It's all right. It made it more sort of a colloquial and friendly rather than a scripted moment.
Yeah, I appreciate where you're coming from. Yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah. You know, like people that like take away punctuation when they're writing, you know, it's, you know, sure. Just what I'm going for.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to do that one.
Yeah. But do that.
Star-studded cast.
A delightful cast. We got a dual role for Mr. Jack Nicholson.
Dual or three? Did he play three parts?
It's very possible. I haven't seen this in a really fucking long time. I'm actually I'm really excited for this because, like, spoiler alert for next episode, I remember this movie being delightful and fun.
Yeah, and I remember seeing this with my family on Christmas Eve because we would always go see a movie on Christmas Eve. And my mom hated it to the point of, like, bringing it up years and years and years, right. And years afterwards. Like, well, nothing can be as bad as that Mars movie.
Yeah.
So, but I remember liking it, but I remember it also being like really out there. So we'll see if I still enjoy it.
This is of the list of Tim Burton films. This is the one that I'm on like muddiest footing where I remember liking it, but boy, I feel, I mean, I may even like it more, but it's one of those ones that it could go, there's a huge sway of where it could move. Cause
right, yeah.
My tolerance for annoying movies is a lot lower than it used to be.
Right. Yeah. We'll see.
Yeah. All right. So do that. Follow us on Twitter at JawsPod. Go to Facebook where John and Alex hate stuff.
Yeah. And stay safe out there.
I don't want to slam. Go spit in each other's mouths. Like, let's fucking make the world sexy again.
It's sexy is to spit in each other's mouths. I guess. I mean, if you're into that, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Look, don't crone shame.
Yeah. No, it's cool. We're still 6 feet apart.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you spit from the other side of the room and I catch it in my mouth, we're safe.
It's safe. Yeah. Yeah. We're following directions.
Yeah. I'll just get some of that French drug that I own stake in their company. It'll cure everything.
Yeah. Of course.
What a fucking shithole we live in. Anyway, thanks, guys. Hope everybody's good. Bye.
Bye.